Hello, and welcome to the February 6th, 2024 episode of the Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. This is Craig W. Hurst, Emeritus Professor of Music, podcasting from my music bunker, along with my faithful canine companion, Carmel the Wonder Dog, to share with you my latest musical interests and discoveries. I claim no special inside information about the latest or greatest music, nor do I know everything there is to know about music. What I am is a lover of music. I enjoy several genres of music, and I share with you what has currently caught my interest, old, new, outdated, and everything in between. Even old music is brand new if you have never heard it before. The universe of music is a vast one to enjoy. From my discussions, you might find something new to you and of interest to expand your own musical universe. I currently receive no compensation or motivation of any kind from any recording label, recording artist, or the estate of any performer or composer dead and gone to discuss their music and or recordings. Now, with that out of the way, welcome to my musical universe. My guest today is singer, songwriter, pianist, poet, and storyteller, Annie Moskow. Annie Moskow is a woman who has clearly found her voice. Her sixth studio album and first solely acoustic project, Land of Dreams, released in February 2024, showcases this voice, strong and unique, both in sound and perspective. In her barest sound to date, Moskow strips her rich and diverse musical influences down to the essentials, exposing a perceived vulnerability mixed with hard-won wisdom gained through life experience. The new album shines a bright light on Annie Moskow's singer-songwriter roots, where she has never been one to shy away from deeply personal and profoundly revelatory themes, and this is no exception. Moskow delivers, engages, and disarms, sometimes resolute and sometimes with the wry, subtle humor which resonates and endears her music to so many. Although no stranger to the recording studio, this is the first time Moskow has sat in the producer's chair alongside co-producer John Herrera of Clamsville Studios, and the album showcases some of Arizona's top musicians, including Kenny Skaggs, played with Glenn Campbell on slide guitar, and jazz great Dom Moyo on percussion. Also featured are the exquisite brother harmonies and cello and guitar pickings of the California folk duo, the Brothers Landau. The songs on Land of Dreams were incubated and inspired in part by the COVID years. The observational tone sets the stage for all that follows. Songs as culminations of a lifetime of observations, impressions, and epiphanies that have nudged Annie Moskow forward to clarity and eventual empowerment. I used to think getting older was about getting wrinkles and a few gray hairs, Moskow says, but it's so much more than that. So many things you know are going to be forever. Well, they're not. People leave. Entire realities change. All we really ever have is ourselves. It took me a long time to figure that out. Moscow began her early music career as a pianist and songwriter and shot up the charts as a songwriter for film, television, and a diverse roster of artists, including Sarah Vaughan, Kathy Sledge, and Mickey Mouse. In 2001, Moscow stepped out on her own with her first solo CD, Wolves at My Door, delving full throttle at that time into relatively taboo and untouched topics, including midlife disillusionment and family dysfunction. Critics called Wolves a sweeping cinematic masterpiece of midlife awakening. Abigail Trafford of the Wall Street Journal wrote, "Annie Moscow is rewriting the rules." Annie Moscow continued to branch out as an independent artist, further spreading her wings as an actress, playwright, and comedian. In 2009, she wrote a one-woman show to showcase some of her songs, The Philosophical Musings of a Suburban Dwelling Free Spirit Ex-Hippie Wannabe with Longings for Connection and Security. After a two-week run at the Herberger Theater in Phoenix, Arizona, she was invited back for the next 12 years to write, produce, and perform 12 more shows, all featuring her original music, most recently the 2022 musical comedy Space Odyssey, Contact, sort of. As many an audience member has attested, no one leaves an Annie Moscow show without knowing not only more about Annie Moscow, but more about themselves. With Moscow's gift for melody and dramatic cinematic storytelling, her songs and performances often elicit comparisons to other dynamic pianist cultural documentarians, including Billy Joel, Laura Nyro, and Carole King. Moscow's fifth CD, Passing Trains, was produced by the late John Jennings, who also worked with Mary Chapin Carpenter and John Gorka, and was released in 2017. The album climbed to number 20 on the folk DJ charts in the first month of its release. In 2020, when the world went into lockdown, Annie Moscow used that quiet time to create and reflect on a lifetime of twists and turns, lost loves, and lessons learned. This world continues to reveal itself as being a fragile and ephemeral as the land of dreams, says Moscow. I believe we are all great creators, and I'm sure I've stepped in every pothole imaginable, reap the consequences, and no doubt will continue to step in a few more. But every day I get better at nursing the bruises, dusting myself off, and moving on. Life is an amazing teacher when you pay attention, and it can also be an amazing ride. Annie Moscow lives in Phoenix, Arizona, where she shares a house with her beautiful grand piano and original artwork by herself and wonderful artist friends that come and go. It is my pleasure to welcome to my musical universe, Annie Moscow. Hello, Annie.
Hi.
It's really great to talk with you and have you as a guest today on my podcast. I want to get right to it. You okay. Just released your newest album last week. For my listeners, this particular episode is being released in February, and Annie's just released an album by the time you hear this. So would you start by highlighting some of the songs that are on the album, or what you would like to tell us about this album that's been released here in February?
Oh, sure. The album is called Land of Dreams. And I've been thinking about what the most important songs on the album are. I mean, of course, they're all my babies. I love them all. But if I were to pick just a few, I think Open Dream was probably a pivotal one because I'm always writing, but I never know when I'm going to say, okay, it's time, we're going in the studio. Mm-hmm. And Open Dream came to me in a dream. Mm-hmm. And just left such a strong impression, and the song just left a big deal on me. And I said, you know, this is the crux of what the whole collection is about. Now it's time. So that mm-hmm. was a real, I guess, impetus song, or so that was an important one. And another really important one too, that I think highlights the whole curve of the album and what the album is about. It's about me finally getting some things right, you know, and coming into my own, saying, oh yeah, oh yeah. And the song, Who Will I Be Good For Now? It was inspired by a conversation with a friend. Mm-hmm. And my friend had lost her husband a few years back. And I've had significant losses in my life as well of mm-hmm. people that have been very instrumental in my life. And we just started talking, and she said to me, you know, the weirdest thing, I think I'm okay now, but the weirdest thing that keeps coming up for me is, who am I going to run into the next room and say, hey, look what I'm doing. Who will I be good for now? And that just hit me like a sucker punch, like, mm-hmm. whoa, who will I be good for now? And I said, that's a song. And I wrote the song inspired by our conversation. But funny story, at the end of the song, originally I was singing Who Will I Be Good For Now, you know, just kind of mourning and questioning the loss of this person. And then I realized, who will I be good for now? Mm-hmm. And I realized it's got to be me. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm the one who's got to say, yeah, you did a good job. Yeah, it's okay. Yeah, here's how to change the light bulb. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's my turn to be good for me. And I changed some of the ad libs at the end of the song to reflect that. And it's like, wow, that's what this album really is. It's mm-hmm. it's taking care of myself. It's doing it the way I need to do it. It's being good for me. So I would say those are probably the two most instrumental songs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it seems to me, and certainly, you know, correct me if you disagree, I've, you know, interviewed a number of musicians, composers, singer-songwriters uh-huh. that all seem to point to the COVID pandemic as a point where there was a lot of time for self-reflection. And a lot of right. the work that they have done, either during the pandemic or after, has really seemed to focus on this improvement of a relationship with myself.
Interesting.
Kind of similar to what you're talking about, self-care yeah. and so on. Right. And I think that's rather interesting from the perspective of, you know, I mean, it's a cliche, charity starts at home, you know, but it also the idea of you've got to take care of yourself before if you're going to take care of others.
Right.
Because
right.
if you break down, then, you know, you're going to have a real hard time of it. And I think that's not only on a physical level, but also on an emotional and psychological level mm-hmm. as well.
100%.
You know, I look at numbers of friends or acquaintances who are caretakers of either their elderly spouses or in some cases, parents or other relatives.
Right.
And it can really be a drain. Uh-huh. on the caretaker. And we sometimes don't think to take time to take care of ourselves and realize that, you know, that we need a hug and some,
right.
some indication of importance as well. So, yeah, I think that's a common theme that I'm running across.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Well, I think so. Well, the pandemic was a really, I guess a significant sort of moment for all of us being, you know, confined. And it's sort of like experiencing what my wife and I are experiencing over the past few days. We haven't really gone much of anywhere because of the wind chills and the snow and so on. And so it's kind of like I'm starting to feel again as I recall back when the pandemic was going and so on.
Kind of
But
shut
any
in.
yeah,
Yeah,
kind of not quite the
yeah.
same, not quite the same,
Right.
but
Right.
nonetheless, you know, when it's 24 degrees below zero with the wind chill, that's you know, that could be dangerous if you're exposed to it.
Right.
So you don't go out.
Of course.
Yeah. But
Yeah.
anyway, well, with the recording, you produced the album, but you
Right.
also had a great co-producer with John Herrera. And how much of his direction and contribution built the final product of your songs on the album?
A lot, a
Yeah.
lot. I mean, I'm not an engineer,
Okay.
but I've been doing albums for years. You know, this is my
Sure.
sixth one, and I've been in the studio and I know what I want. And I chose all the musicians and I arranged all the songs, and so I did all the big picture work, but in the studio it depended on John. Of course, he was behind the board, and I felt like, the lady in the car mechanic, I would go, I wanted to go chugga chugga chugga, and the mechanic would go, okay, and he would have all the technical terms, and John had that, he was my translator, and he had ideas of his own. Of course, he's really musical and he had great ideas, and I would tell him sort of what I was feeling, what I would want. We would talk about it. And sometimes he was able to get the performances out of the musicians because he could explain it better than what I was saying.
Okay.
And also, especially towards the end of the project, when what I was hearing and what I was wanting was like maybe 80% doing it for me. And again, the lady in the car mechanic, this just isn't giving me the dreamy effect I want. This just isn't going like this for me. And John would make suggestions and bring in a couple of his people to take it up to where I was saying. So it was very much a co-production, very much. And of course, I couldn't have done it without him. I mean, what am I going to do it in my little band camp thing, So,
Well, did any of the songs on the album turn out really differently after being in the studio than you had conceived them going in? And if so, which ones and how did they change?
well, they all opened out once everyone got on. It was
Okay.
super exciting to watch. Really, really exciting. Of course, Who Will I Be Good For Now, because of the ending that I changed. But I think the biggest one musically was I'm a pianist and I write every part. That's just, if I hear a drummer, I'm going like this. And so it's always a challenge for me to kind of weed myself out of the arrangement to leave room for other people to play. And one of the songs, Gypsy Dancer, I heard is being this big, exciting gypsy dance, just opening up and the gypsies dancing. And I knew I wanted a violin on it, but piano-wise, I believed I had it covered going in. I had this really exciting tarantella, and it was really fun to play. It's like, yeah, I've got this, me and a violin, we're going to cover it. Well, when I heard how much the other songs were just growing and growing and growing as we added the musicians, and I heard my little tarantella part on the piano on Gypsy Dancer, and even with the violin, it still wasn't going to where I wanted it to go. I mean, it was sort of working, but it wasn't where I wanted it to go. Well, John was in a band in the 90s called Turning Point, and they were a smooth jazz fusion band, and he played with two Greek brothers who live in town, the Sonos brothers. And Thanos is a bouzouki prodigy. And he was a friend of John's. And John said, let me bring Thano in. Let's see what Thano can do. And oh my God, the song, it explodes. Thono is extraordinary. And so musically, that one just took off to the stratosphere. I just love what he did. And that was a complete surprise, not a surprise, because, you know, I knew what we were doing. But when Thanos did that, it just took it to a whole nother level. So, yeah.
Well, when you, you know, like you said, you've recorded five albums. This is your sixth one. You know, is your typical, well, and typical is always difficult because not every project is the same. But do you consider yourself sort of like when you get ready to record, you bring in kind of bare bones and then let the other musicians help flesh out a particular song? Or do you pretty much have conceptually everything all worked out and then just get people to record the sounds that you want?
It's been a very evolving process.
Okay.
Like, I did my first album in 2000.
Okay.
And at that time, I was just a piano player who wrote my songs, and my producer had their own vision, and they took it to their own places and brought in their musicians. And at the end of it, I was like, oh, okay. You know, and it was a great album, but it's not something I ever would have conceived to do myself. But at the same point, I didn't know what I would have conceived to do myself, because, like I said, I had my melody, my chords, my piano. And over the years, I've been a little more vocal about what I want, a little more, let's try this. And it's been kind of wiggly. Because when I had a great producer who had their own vision, it really stood together with their vision. And then when I started inserting my vision, you know, it was immature at first. And my producer was trying to honor that, yet do their own thing. And I just wasn't ever happy. You know, it just wasn't coming to what I wanted. And this time, I had a full vision. I could hear all the parts, and I brought in musicians who all have jazz backgrounds. So I knew the form of the arrangement, of course, the harmonic structure, and everyone worked from charts, but only chord charts. Everybody pretty much improvised their own parts, pretty much improvised their own parts around my piano part that I had to, like I said, take some stuff out.
Well, that's interesting. I think that, you know, I ask that question of pretty much every guest that I have, that, you know, because I always find the creative process very fascinating, and how some people will, you know, they like to, and it's a trust issue as well, because you know, when you go in the studio, if you're in the studio with people you've worked with before, and you know you can trust their judgment, and you know that if they suggest something, it's probably going to be a good suggestion. There's a great working relationship that, you know, that idea that two heads are better than one, you know, to kind of bring the culmination, the vision that you have for your work. You know, and it's not necessarily a solitary kind of event. I know some people, however, that do work that way.
But not at all.
I've always been, you know, very much enjoy, like with my own groups, even in rehearsal process, if we're rehearsing a chart and I'll say, hey, any ideas on how to make this go better? And somebody will say, well, yeah, what if we try that? But, you know, we do. And it's just, you know, I guess there's a difference between being authoritarian versus a little more democratic in the process. And everybody's a little bit different, but it's I think just fascinating to me how the process works. And I know too, it's like I have a good friend of mine who's a studio musician at Capitol Records in LA, and he always tells me that when they go in for a session, he says his number one job, he always is considered his number one job, is to whoever the, you know, the headliner is, whoever's on the session, right? It's to make them sound better than they think they do, you know, by providing, you know, not only reading down the music that you're given to play behind somebody, but also offering a level of interpretation that enhances what they're doing. And I think that, when you bring people together to record your music, it sounds like, it's a similar kind of thing, and you have to trust those people that they're going to do that. And I think that's a wonderful way to work, first of all. And because I would be the first one to tell you, I never have all the answers. Yeah, and it's always
No,
good to get feedback.
I knew everyone. I love them all. They're all really, really good friends. I trusted. I love them musically. And most of the basis of the tracks we just recorded live. I mean, some we had to do several times. But yeah, there was a huge level of trust. There were no egos, let's try this, let's try that. So it was trust and collaborative, 100% with everyone.
Yeah, and I love music. I love music making like that. I really
It was
do.
beautiful. It's beautiful.
Well, getting to kind of an aesthetic question. The ancient Greeks claimed that the purpose of tragedy and drama was to serve as an emotional catharsis for those who witness the drama. You could witness the emotional pain that you were watching happening on stage without having to actually bear that pain and still feel cleansed emotionally. And you've spoke somewhat to this because your new album is a lot about you, but do you overall it, kind of look, the overarching look at your work, not necessarily just this latest album, but the overarching kind of look at 30,000 feet, if you will, of your work. Do you see the aesthetic purpose of your songs to provide an emotional cleansing for your listeners? Or are you, as some other songwriters have done, are you simply serving as an observer of human situations and our relationships and then making personal commentary?
Well, I mean, of course, there's two parts.
Okay.
The end result is you hope it's going to touch people and they're going to feel that. And when they do, it's the most rewarding thing in the world because you realize you're doing something meaningful. You're out there in the world with a purpose and it's reflecting back. And there's nothing better. But when I originally sit down and write the songs, it's a very personal thing. I'm writing because I'm trying to make sense of something. I'm trying to get inside of an emotion and just kind of write it out. And sometimes I don't, I might not even know what I'm thinking, but I'm feeling the strong emotion. Then throughout the day, all these little lines will start popping. I was like, oh my God, here comes a song, And because it's the songs come from me trying to make sense of things I might be going through, but the end result is really for the world when it's out in the world. And
Sure.
yeah.
Well, I'm curious when you talk about this, you get an idea, the initial concept hits you. What then comes first? A lyric or a melodic idea or a rhythmic idea?
Almost always lyrics.
Okay, a lyric. Okay.
Almost always lyrics. I'd say 90, 95%.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. The melodies that I get, I usually wake up with.
Okay.
But melodies don't like pop up throughout the day, or sometimes I'm just sitting down at the piano and something will start flowing through. But the lyrics, most of the time.
Do once you start putting lyrical content together, then do the lyrics generate a melodic idea?
Yes.
Okay.
Like I said, I get snippets all the time and pieces of lyrics and sometimes hooks. And when it starts growing to, good percentage and I look at it, it's done, that's when I'll sit down at the piano and just start kind of playing and see what falls in and experiment with different things. And then it all kind of grows up together.
Well, and I ask that question because of my own personal experience, and I'm just curious what others are, because I have a tendency to think melodically. I know that sounds weird, but you know,
No,
I can
people are different. Yeah.
I can see an image or a person, or I can even see a picture in my mind's eye, and a
Right.
melody will come to mind.
Wow, nice.
I don't think in terms of a lyric, because well, I'm not a songwriter. I'm an instrumentalist, so that's probably
Okay.
why. But I just always curious if you know what we think of in terms of musical thinking is if you know if, for those of us that are artists, you know, when you're presented with a concept or an image, if what pops out when your muse spews is some sort of melody or a rhythm or something that is in response to that. And I think that's always something I think about.
Interesting.
But for you,
Yeah.
it sounds like maybe you're a poet first.
Yeah. I mean, I've been playing piano since I was four, but my family tells me, and not in a flattering way, that since I was three, I would stand in the middle of the living room and recite poetry to
Oh,
everybody, you know.
really?
So I apologize to my family, you know, because I'm sure it couldn't have been fun for everyone. But yeah, I've been writing and reading, reciting poetry, I guess, since I came out of the womb.
Oh
So
my.
that's my first
Okay.
muse.
All right. So
Yeah.
the word. Yeah,
Yeah.
I'm laughing only because
Yeah.
I can remember when I was a child,
Right.
I used to stand on the in front of the fireplace, and it had a raised we had a fireplace. It was kind of raised above the floor, and so I'd stand up on the little ledge like it was a little stage, and I would sing, and it was
Oh my God, you
but it
too.
would be but it would be nonsense words because I would be like I was imitating what I'd seen on TV or something, but I didn't really have a song that I knew, or I didn't it'd just be these dumb little words I'd make up. But I guess I was just an exhibitionist from the word go, you know,
Yeah, I'm sure I
something
was
about
too.
being a performing artist, right?
I know, it's
Yes,
wonderful.
yes,
Wonderful.
yeah. It's a curse
Yeah.
for our family sometimes, so.
I know.
Well, Annie, let's talk about you as a performer, and what I'm really interested in is what's the makeup of your musical DNA? Who were models for your vocal style and quality?
I love the quirky, expressive singers. My models, I mean, Joni Mitchell was my first musical heartthrob, you know. I would, the way she goes up and down and that kind of yodel, I mean, it's like, oh, you know, I want to be like her. And then I fell in love with the delivery of Phoebe Snow and Beth Orton. She's got like this smoky kind of really conversational delivery. So really the quirky singers, because we talk about our muses and what we do and everything, and you know, Celine Dion, Adele, the real belters, powerhouse singers. I mean, I think they're wonderful, but I knew that's not who I was. But the quirky, expressive ones, Norah Jones, you know, it's like I love that. Those are the singers that move me most, and that's who I want to be when I grow up. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, then, from the singer-songwriter standpoint, who are some
Yeah.
singer-songwriters that you admire and maybe even emulate in your own writing?
Right. I mean, all the above, of course. And I've been compared to Laura Nyro because I like to write epics, you know. And Billy Joel, some of the old school storytellers. I love Sting, just because of his whole sensibility and melody and everything. I've never been compared to Sting, but I just love him. So, yeah, the storytellers. Ben Folds. Ben Folds, yeah.
Well, I love you know, I love storytellers. I guess that's part of why
Yeah.
I like to listen to country music, because you know they say country music tells a story. But I've also been very much drawn to singers and songwriters who create incredible imagery. That when I listen to their song, I can hear and smell and everything that, you know,
oh,
what they're
yeah.
describing in the song.
I just got a chill when you're saying that.
Yeah, I think of
Yeah.
people like, I think of people like Tom Waits, you know, and he's
Oh,
talking
I
about,
love Tom
yeah,
Waits.
and when he's
I
talking about,
love Tom Waits. Yeah.
when he's
Yeah.
talking about a particular scene, and you can see, just see that. Yeah, I mean, those are, but then in a sense, that's a story too, when you're so evocative in your descriptive narrative that it's you know, painting a picture with
Oh,
words.
he's an amazing poet.
Oh yeah. And
Yeah,
I just
yeah.
yeah, I love those kinds of things. But that's yeah, that's really interesting, the storytellers, 'cause I think you tell stories in your songs.
I do.
You
I
know,
do.
and I
Yeah.
so I'm not surprised that you would say that. Yeah, well, that's great. Well, okay. Well, you know, the next thing I'd like to ask you about, and most everyone always tells me this is the hardest question I ask,
Oh no.
because that's okay. It's nothing that's going to put you on the spot. It's just sometimes you have to think for a minute. But what have been some of your most memorable musical experiences? See, told
Last
you.
year. Oh no, you're making me think. Last year I saw Jacob Collier live and he just blew me away. It was so beautiful, and he's a prodigy on everything, and just his energy and joy. And I was standing there thinking, I'm watching Mozart here. I mean, he was spectacular. And then for a few weeks after that, I watched every video, listened to every recording. I just couldn't get enough of what he had done. And yeah, a lot of the prodigies, like Imogen Heap is the prodigy in what she does, and the famous Tommy Emmanuel, I saw him live as like, whoa. So yeah, the prodigies are always really inspiring, and equally inspiring are the great singer-songwriters who aren't necessarily prodigies, but they surround themselves with wonderful people, and their concerts are just so powerful and so moving. And again, it's inspiring to me as not being a Celine Dion type to say, okay, well, this is okay too. You know, you make beautiful music, you don't have to be the fastest gun in the West, you know. You do what you do, you put it out there, and people like what you have to say and express, or they don't. But it was intimidating to me at one point of watching these prodigies, you know, say, oh, I'll never play again. But you don't have to be at that level, because there's so many great, amazing singer-songwriters out there that I actually like even more.
Okay, so those are some wonderful experiences as an observer. How about some memorable experiences as a performer?
As a performer,
Yeah, what's some of your most memorable gigs?
well, my first one as a singer songwriter, absolutely, because my background was I thought I was going to be a concert pianist when I was younger, and that's when I went, you know, I went to conservatory, and then I was a lyricist for years, and I didn't come out as a singer songwriter till I was close to 40. And I had been writing poetry my whole life, so I had all these poems that I turned into songs, and but no one had ever heard them, you know, they were all my personal little and a friend of mine said, no, you have to get these out, because apparently they were resonating with anyone I played with. So I said, okay, I'm going to do an album. So I did, and a friend who has a big property with an auditorium on it and everything, she goes, we're going to host a concert for you. I'm like, okay. And so she hosted this concert, and there were probably like, I don't know, 70, 80 people there. And I had never sung in public. I had never been a singer-songwriter in public. I'd only been a pianist. And when my first reaction was when I was playing, I remember thinking really strongly, why is everybody looking at me? Because as a pianist, you always kind of look down, and the connection was, it threw me, the connection with the audience, that they were connecting so strong, and I just wanted to go hide in a corner somewhere. But I stayed with it, and at the end of the show, all these people were coming up to me, and like the second part of what we were talking about, they were saying, you're singing my songs. And I realized how much people were resonating what I was saying. All these songs I thought I was writing for me were going out in the world, like I said. And my first time out the gate, all these people were coming up to me, and it was so moving. I went home, I just cried, I guess, out of joy, you know. It was so overwhelming. So yeah, that was probably my most powerful music
Wow.
experience, was that first show.
I think
Yeah.
yeah, that
Yeah.
sounds like it. I mean, I'm really
Yeah.
amused by your comment about why is everybody looking at me?
I
Well, I mean, if you've been used to, quite frankly,
Right.
if you've been used
Right.
to creating music inside of, say, your own echo chamber and
Right.
not really getting out to the public, that's really a very different kind of experience.
Very much so.
I mean,
Yeah.
it's sort of like when I was in music school and we, used to talk about don't be a practice room trumpet player. I play trumpet.
Wow. Okay.
And that's because in the practice room you develop a particular you get used to a particular sound in that smaller room, but we
Interesting.
don't perform in there. You perform in an
Right.
auditorium. So
Right.
the idea was to every once in a while sneak into the recital hall, practice a little bit. But I can I know what you mean in that, and I think lay people don't always understand this, that there is a large part of isolation on the part of people who are musicians and artists, because we do spend an inordinate amount of time preparing and practicing our
Right.
craft before we ever put it before the public.
Right.
And the public only sees the tip of the iceberg,
Right.
literally. And I so
Right.
I empathize and sympathize at the same time with your why is everybody looking at me kind of thing.
Right.
Because that's really a different kind of experience.
And another funny part to that too. I mean, I love performing, and I go for it, you know, and I just, I'm so comfortable up there, and I love being with the people that come to see me, and it's so much fun for me. And you know, and people that see me perform, you know, sometimes they'll be, well, guys in the audience will say, you know, they think I'm one way, or even women that want to be my friend, they think I'm one way. And then we get to know each other a little bit, and I'm actually kind of a nerd, you know. And they're like, and I'm like, oh, I have trouble, or maybe they have trouble making peace with who was that on stage, you know, with this kind of quiet person that doesn't like to go out all night and, you know, party or whatever. Yeah, so different sides of people come out.
Well, and that's the thing,
Yeah,
I mean, it's just, I
yeah.
think this is probably true of anybody who's in the public eye is
Yeah,
the
yeah.
adoring public doesn't see them in their, how they are off camera or
Right,
off
right.
stage, and they
Yeah.
don't realize that when we're on stage in front of an
Right.
audience, we're performing, which means that we've got our
Right.
game face on,
Good way to, yeah, good way to put it. Yeah.
and so who we really are is sometimes something that's very different than what they expect.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, that's always interesting to think about and hear about others' experience. I've got a
Yeah.
question for you, Annie. If there was any artist you could perform with, alive or dead, who would it? And I mean, that has
Right.
passed, but assuming that we could bring them back, who would it be and why? Who would you want to perform with?
Okay, I've got a couple.
Oh, that's fine.
Okay. I have always loved James Taylor's voice and guitar, and the guitar player who I have on the album, I love him. Daniel Landau, he actually reminds me a little bit of James Taylor. So if not Daniel, then James Taylor. And his brother David, a phenomenal cello player, but if not David, I would take Yo-Yo Ma. But the person who I truly would love to work with in the studio is Billy Childs, because he produced one of my favorite albums of all times, Map to the Treasure by Laura Nyro. And again, there's a similarity in my writing to some of the things Laura does or Laura Nyro did. She's one of the ones we don't have anymore. But just the stories and the way he tells her stories on this album, it's just beautiful, and the harmonic arrangements. So yeah, he'd be top of my wish list
Okay.
to work with in the studio.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I always find that's an interesting question. Not so much the who, but the why. And I think your why is a
Yeah.
really, really an excellent response in terms of how it would help you. Well, if you were doing an album and having him work with you, that would really be great. Well, you've already kind of
Yeah.
answered this question,
Okay.
and that is, I
Okay.
was going to ask you if you're currently writing any new songs, and I'll bet you are, because you talk about getting ideas on a
Right,
regular
right.
basis. So,
Yeah.
what do you do with those ideas? Do you keep a sketchbook of ideas, of lyrics or melodic ideas or other things, and then draw upon them later to actually write a song?
I wish I were organized enough to keep one sketchbook,
Yeah.
but they're everywhere.
Okay.
There's different books, and I'll find something buried in a closet, from like 10 years ago, and I'll open it up and say, "Oh, that's a nice lyric." And I try to put stuff on my computer, but wherever I'm at, scraps and ideas and things. And like I said, when stuff starts to come together, I know it's time to sit down and write, which is what Open Dream was for me on this project. Right now, my head is filled with the work I'm doing to, tell people about my latest album. And I'm also writing kind of a book that's going to come out later in the year to go with that. So my most serious writing time versus sitting down at the piano and writing a song is going into my book and going into, answering questions for people, things like that. But it'll come. It'll come. It's just not on the front burner right now.
Yeah, well,
Yeah.
you got to take care of business, and
Right.
you've got to promote
Right.
the new album, and if
Yeah.
you've got this book coming out, when do you anticipate the book will be out?
I'm hoping by summer. Depends how fast I can write, but definitely before the end of the year.
Oh, wonderful,
Definitely before the
wonderful.
end of the year.
And
Yeah.
so this book will definitely be a companion for the new album.
Yes, not 100%, but it's structured around the songs of the new album. Because people are always asking me, what does this line mean? What does this line mean? How'd you come up with this? What's that? And the backstory, it's not always so simple,
Of course.
and my first thought was, well, who wants to hear this whole, and apparently some people do, because you start talking and people are interested. So it's like, okay, I'm going to put this down. So it's kind of memoirish, but not completely. It's not when I was five, but stories that relate to the songs and the emotions and the experience of song and where it came from on as deep a level as I'm comfortable with talking about it.
I see. Well, that's
Yeah.
good. So it kind of gives
Yeah.
an explication of your lyric and your work. So that sounds interesting.
Yeah.
But
Yeah.
yeah, I mean, it's sort of like questions. I used to teach music appreciation at the university, among many other things.
Nice.
And I very often, you know, the question I would always get from students, particularly about instrumental pieces, is, you know, is Dr. Hurst, what does it mean? And I, my response would be, well, what do you think it means? What,
right.
You, what right. kind of visual imagery do you have when you hear mm-hmm. this, you know, and, or what kind of day was the composer having when they wrote this music?
Nice.
You know, had they, were they excited? Were they happy? Had they just been jilted by their girlfriend, you know, whatever, or
right.
boyfriend? And, you know, what sort of emotion can you assign to it? And
right.
I think people are interested in talking about, you know, those kinds of things in music. Uh-huh. So, yeah, the book sounds like a very exciting and enterprising project to go along
Thank
with
you.
Your other artistic work. That's
yeah.
wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, okay, now I know that you are focusing on the new album. It isn't quite out yet. Let's see. The release date is the, February 2nd.
Right, right.
And so we're not quite there, just a couple of weeks away yet. But by chance, now that this one's coming out, are you thinking about or even conceiving about your next album? And are you thinking about at all what direction you might take with another project?
I know that my harmonic palette has been expanding by leaps and bounds just
okay.
these past couple years. And I've been really getting into jazz, not so much what, you know, bebop type, but like the harmonic structure mm-hmm. and the chords and the freedom. So I believe it's going to go more in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
Open out my songs. Billy Childs, are you listening?
Yeah.
You
know?
But it's where I'm going naturally. I've mm-hmm. even been playing around with some songs that I've written before. Now they're expanding more, and I'm doing new chord voicings and new arrangements. So melodically I see a big expansion.
Mm-hmm.
And melodically, harmonically, and lyrically, you know, we're always evolving as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure what my next period is going to be. You know,
mm-hmm.
I was in the angry period, then the sad period, then the happy period. You know, I'm not sure what my next,
mm-hmm.
and actually when I feel solidly in a new phase of life or new, that's when the songs start, you know, all coming together and saying, okay, we're ready for collection. So I don't
mm-hmm.
know what that's going to be
mm-hmm.
just yet,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
but I know harmonically and musically, I've been going in a lot of new directions. So
okay.
I know that's going to happen.
Oh, that's awesome. I mean, I
think,
you know, the idea of no one, you know, it's unfortunate, I guess, in some ways that it seems like the consuming public, they always like to complain that there's nothing new. And then when something new comes out, it's like, oh, I don't like it because it's not like what we're used to.
I know, right?
You know, and I used to,
yeah.
You know, when I taught history of rock and roll, I tell my students about how Geffen Records once sued Neil Young because he put out a recording that, in the opinion of the record company execs, didn't sound like him. You know, in other words, didn't sound like the product that they expected that Neil Young would produce. And
isn't that awful that
well,
has to be? Yeah.
It's that commodity kind of thinking.
Right.
And artists
right.
evolve, artists change. I mean, you
right.
talk about jazz. I think one of the greatest models of how someone can change is to look at Miles Davis and how his musical language changed, you know, from decade to decade. I mean, the Miles Davis of 1970 is very different from the Miles Davis of 1950 or
right.
1960, you know what I mean?
Right.
And I think he accomplishes that by bringing on other people like Wayne Shorter,
Wayne Shorter.
Herbie Hancock, you know, people
right.
with very exciting sort of ideas in terms of harmony and melody, and kind of help
Right.
push his envelope, which he then pushed back in a very, very interesting way. And when I hear you talk about, you're getting interested in a more varied harmonic palette,
And
and
expansive.
yes,
Expansive,
and
yeah.
starting to think. I mean, that's the thing that I. You know, I've loved jazz for a long, long time, and I've always
Yeah.
contended it's because of major and minor sevenths.
I love the minor seventh. Yeah.
Yes, yes. Well, I can still remember when I was like just in beginning band, and we had this one piece, and it seemed like it had this very hip sounding sound, and I always liked playing that song. But I'll look forward to hearing what you might come up with
Oh, thank you.
with that application of
Yeah.
that more varied harmonic palette. And that's, it's another way I used to describe, when you're teaching college students about music, and we'd talk about different colors and so forth, and how I'd say,
Yeah.
well, most pop musicians will stick with the primary colors, red and blue and yellow, right? And then you
Right,
get
right.
but jazz musicians like to get into, and they start combining things and recombining things and using upper partials of the harmonic
Right.
theories, and really opening our ears up to some very delicious kinds of sounds that
Right.
are not as, say, harmonically direct, but more harmonically suggestive, and
Right.
yet are very cool to listen to, and all that kind of stuff,
Right.
So it sounds like you're expanding your vocabulary and so on. We could look for some really nice things that are going to be
Thank
coming up.
you. And those are the players I always surround myself with are good jazz players. That's always what I've got in my band, even though I can't do what they can do. I love that they're with me and what they bring.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it's always nice to hear, and somebody, you go, man, that's really a hip sound. What is it you're doing there? Oh, well, it's an F minor major ninth chord or something, and you just, oh, okay. Well, anyway, just to shift gears a little bit, just so we can plug what you're up to. Do you have any
Thank you.
live shows coming up? And if you do, where are venues where you typically appear?
I've got a bunch in Arizona where I live, that are still coming in, and you can check my website and see what's popping in. But I play at the Nash pretty regularly, which is our jazz club in Phoenix. And I play at the ASU Care Cultural Center. I have something we're working on now, and a bunch of festivals and things. And like I said, everything's on my site, so check it out for what's popping in. And I'm working on some dates in California for June, but haven't solidified yet. So, and
Okay.
hopefully a lot more once we get the album out and see what comes in.
Well, wonderful. Well, just to remind my listeners, and just so you know, in my show notes, I always
Okay.
include your web address,
Thank you.
so people can link directly to your website and keep up with you and learn more about you, and also your Facebook page. And so we want to make sure people are informed if they're in the Phoenix area or out in California when you're performing, and be able to check you out live. I think
Thank
that
you.
sounds like a lot of fun. Well, Annie, I try to be as thorough as I can be when I think of questions I want to ask an artist, but I also know I'm not perfect. So the last question that I'm going to
Oh
ask
no.
you is there anything else you'd like to add or tell my audience that I have not asked you about?
Oh no. I mean, you are really thorough and I don't know. Is there anything else you'd like to ask me?
You know, I've really touched on a lot of things that are important to me. I'm always interested in creative process and work that you're doing or that you have coming up soon, and your experiences and things. I mean, that's why I ask the questions that I ask, because I think about, as a musician myself, things that I might want to be have people ask me. But I mean, if you think I've covered the bases, then if you're happy, I'm happy. That's the most important thing.
Oh, no, this was wonderful. Thank you.
Well,
Really
very
easy
good.
and
Well, very good. Well, Annie, then I want to thank you
Thank
so
you.
very much for taking time out of your day to talk with me. And I want to wish you all the best with
Thank
what I'm
you.
sure is going to be a continued successful musical future.
I so appreciate this. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. And you have
Okay.
a great rest of the day.
Thank you. You too. Okay.
My Discovery Composer of the Week is Eduard Konecki, born in Emmerich in 1885. He died in Berlin in 1953. In Berlin, he attended university lectures on theory and was a composition pupil of Bruch at the Hochschule für Musik. In 1907, he was appointed chorus master at a Berlin operetta theater, after which he was conductor for Max Reinhardt at the Deutsches Theater. During the war, he played the horn in an infantry regiment and afterwards went to the Friedrich Wilhelmstadtisch Theater. The success of Heinrich Bertes, Schubert Pastiche, Das Dreimeterhaus, which Konecki conducted, led him to operetta. In this field, he enjoyed conspicuous international acclaim with Der Wetter aus Dingste from 1921, especially for the tenor solo Ich bin nur ein armer Wandergesell. In the wake of this huge success, Konecki was engaged in 1924 and 1925 to compose works for the Schuberts in New York and one for the Gaiety Theatre in London. These achieved little notice, however, and his further recognition was confined largely to Germany, where he remained the leading exponent of operetta, writing some works in traditional style and others in a more modern dance idiom. Besides his theater pieces, Konecki composed a string quartet, orchestral suites, two piano concertos, and choral and vocal music. In later works, he used jazz, most notably in his Tanzerische Suite of 1929, written for radio. The All Music Guide lists 11 recordings of his operettas, 3 recordings of his piano concerti, and 10 recordings of his songs. In my show notes is a link to a YouTube video performance of Konecki's Ich bin nur ein armer Wandergesell. That wraps episode number 175. My show notes, along with links to artist websites, recording label websites, YouTube videos of artists' performances, are all posted on my Facebook page, The Musical Universe of Professor Hurst. Next week, I will be interviewing East Coast-based folk singer-songwriter Spencer LaJoy. Other upcoming interviews include husband and wife folk duo The Kennedys, genre straddling singer Nina DeVitri, drummer and composer Jake Richter, and saxophonist and composer Anton Deleka. So don't touch that dial and stay tuned. If you have questions, comments, or a suggestion of an artist, composer, or musical style for me to consider, you may email me at hurstc@uwm.edu. So until next time, this is Professor Craig W. Hurst and Carmel the Wonder Dog signing off from the musical universe of Professor Hurst. Have a great day.